Westman saying, I got a great idea for what song we can do, and you're going to do it. So I haven't done this for, like, I don't know, years.
But I thought it was a perfect song for subversive remembering.
There you go.
It's really moves us into that place. So that's, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. I think it will. Particularly if you get into it.
Okay.
Oh, I mean,
Stop talking so we can hear the song.
So this is a song. Okay, stop. This is a song that I wrote with the kids at a camp called Peace Village in Minneapolis. That was put on by the community of St. Martin, started by Josh Ram,
yay,
and some other people. It's just called Basta, which means enough. And we'd love to have you on the chorus. Comes around about 4 billion times. And I go, well, you'll catch it. So I have, this is my able assistant who's going to help me when I forget the words. She's the one that remembered all the words. Okay.
Sometimes
positive verse because you know we hate the people saying those liberals, all they ever do is complain. So I said, no, there are things we actually want. So yeah,
Ray was right.
Yeah.
We're going to try to intersperse these sessions through the week with their wonderful music. Okay, we're going to continue on from last evening, and especially as you heard at breakfast, focusing now in this session on what really are the competing gods that we're facing. Clearly, the matter of interfaith dialogue, when we think of other religions in that sense, is an important kind of agenda. And I'm not in any way wanting to overshadow that. But I think within our own society, it's really important for us to come to grips with the fact that we are dealing with competing gods, including gods that may not necessarily be thought of as religious gods. But I think especially the gods related to market, profit, et cetera, et cetera. And so I begin with just sharing a memory that still is very vivid in my mind from the 1980s when I was teaching at Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago, which of course is very close to the University of Chicago and you know, the whole Chicago School of Economics, et cetera, et cetera, that got started there, Milton Friedman and the rest. And in the 1980s was certainly having significant impact, especially in a lot of Latin American countries. And so I thought, well, I'm going to walk over to hear what was scheduled to be a panel of three of the Nobel laureates in economics who were going to be holding forth in some event. Well, first of all, entering the auditorium was itself a, quote, religious experience, because there were the purple velvet curtains on the stage, and on the high altar, you know, sat the three Nobel laureates and I think one or two others also. And I felt like, you know, I was an alien in a foreign cult, because clearly they were all, you know, many of the graduate students who were determined to eat up every word from these Nobel laureates. And especially to hear them expand upon the economic theories and the faith on which they were based. Now, I think it's only been since the 1980s, that more and more people have become aware of the fact that much of what has been carved out economically has been based on theories that in some way say, well, yeah, this is how it should turn out. And therefore, there's a kind of blind faith that tends to operate. And from that dramatic moment until now, I've become increasingly convinced that the challenge is not so much of the church being able to understand and speak the language and follow the logic of economics, although it helps to be able to do at least some of that. But even more important is for the church to be able to more publicly articulate how different is the logic of biblical faith and Christian discipleship. And I think there's many, many writings of many people who've been here at Holden through the years who've said that again and again in many different ways. And therefore, of different priorities that need to be brought to economic matters. Just the other week I was reading some quote from the late Milton Friedman who talked about, well, when you get these other things in, those are subversive matters. He himself used the word subversive. In other words, it's subversive of free market faith. So, for example, I think one of the ways in which we try to do this in the ELCA when I was directing the department through which the social statements were developed was in the Social Statement on Economic Life, which was developed about 13 years ago and had as its guidelines sufficient sustainable livelihood for all. I remember certainly one of the people who was instrumental in our coming up with that formula was Mary Nelson, the mother or sister of John Nelson, who many of you were celebrating his life last Saturday in Seattle. And that phrase, sufficient sustainable livelihood for all, given the current political climate in the U.S., provides a distinctly counter voice for the church's public witness. It certainly does not resonate well with the angry voices fighting over how to cut the federal budget, but it resonates instead with people like Jim Wallace and the campaign of What Would Jesus Cut, or the circle of protection of religious leaders that actually did in recent months get some media attention, some mainline media attention, which seldom is the case in terms of the church's resistance. Even David Stockman, who served as Reagan's budget director for the biggest tax cuts in U.S. history, at the end of 2010, I think it was on a 60 Minutes report, decried how cutting taxes has become a demigod religion. Mm-hmm. So when even someone like Stockman can say that, I think that's very telling. I would add that the problem arises when the dogma of deregulation, privatization, etc., must be believed. All of those things that I'll use the word neoliberal kind of thinking. I know in an American audience that often, you know, people say, oh, well, liberal, that's good. Well, no. Neoliberal is what the rest of the world would you know, call what is going on in that deprivatization, deregulation, etc. kind of set of doctrines. Especially when those doctrines are followed regardless of what the results will be, especially for those on the margins. Now, what I find somewhat ironic is that it is the church that is usually perceived as promulgating what is to be believed or be accepted by faith, apart from empirical evidence. Economics has been presumed to be based on empirical data. And yet the clear evidence of the failure of a lot of this free market or neoliberal economics, especially in the face of the 2008 economic crisis and its aftermath, has apparently not been sufficient to sway the faith that policymakers still place in its basic tenets. If anything, they have become even more fanatical believers in such. The economy crashed when the purest form of this kind of economics was being pursued. Now, the point here is that this is, I think, a key example of an area where we as churches are urgently called, churches, and I mean the whole people of God, to open up the space, to point to the evidence, and to pose the critical questions. People are acutely feeling betrayed by the promises they have bought into. Often with blind faith that the U.S. economic decision-making will take care of these complicated matters, only to discover that they are mostly beholden to large corporate interests determined to keep the market as free, as unregulated as possible. What's important for us theologically to recognize and to name is that matters of basic meaning, hope, and values are at stake. And those certainly should be at the forefront of what the church is all about. And yet, it is in the last two or three years, it has typically been the journalists and pundits who have named these realities with greater clarity, and occasionally economists who have dared to break with this mainstream economic orthodoxy and name what is going on. For example, Joseph Stiglitz, in his 2010 book called Freefall, asked, "Will we seize the opportunity to restore our sense of balance between the market and the state, between individualism and community, between humans and nature, between means and ends?" He said, we now have the opportunity to create a new financial system and a new system that will create jobs, decent work for all those who want it, one in which the divide between the haves and the have-nots might narrow. But the real danger, as he said in 2010, is that we will not seize this time. And of course, it's even become a more sad, sobering kind of picture since then. To look back at the early church, I think it's significant to find those examples. For example, when Emperor Demetrius, in the third century, who was persecuting the Christians, blamed the Christians for their refusal to worship the Roman gods for the evils of the day. That's why the evils are going on, because you're not worshiping the right God. You're not worshiping the gods of Rome. In response, Cyprian, the bishop of Carthage, defended the church and traced the tragic conditions of the day to the greed of the wealthy. Now, that took some nerve. That was audacious, to say the least. And certainly it was something that, of course, toned down significantly then under the Constantinian era of the church, which in lots of ways still lingers today. Now, at the height of the 2008 economic crisis, many commentators boldly named greed as the central matter that was at stake. But the church's public voice was less audible, even though we can look at 2,000 years of history where, there was some rather bold naming of greed. I think some of the Greek fathers, Basil the Great and others, had some incredibly strong words that probably those of us in the Western Church, aren't as familiar with. But I think that's very much been a part of church history, and yet we haven't necessarily raised that up as much as we need to. Last summer, and I'm going to be doing the PowerPoint soon now. Last summer, when the LWF met in its assembly in Stuttgart, some of us said the times call for significant address of what's going on, and can't we, as LWF, as a communion of 70 million Lutherans around the world, makes some bold statement on this. Now, unfortunately, the statement did not get quite the press that we had hoped it would. But
we'll probably want to scoot the podium over so you aren't standing in.
Okay. Now, the full statement is available on the LWF website, and I do have a hard copy, so we might make some copies if you want a copy while you're here. But I've just prepared four slides, as one who's still learning how to use PowerPoint, thanks to Ray, who helped me put this together. Some strategic parts of that statement that I think are, I'm using this really as an example of what might it mean for the church really to live out that theological outrage in light of what's going on today. And the development of this overall statement was enriched through a process of visits, pilgrimage, and discussions in different parts of the world. And the witness was raised up as to what people in those different contexts are experiencing from the combination of economic policies and their relation to climate change. Because throughout this, I think what we're experiencing in terms of the environment is very much connected with some of the kind of economic, highest growth, how do we get the most of resources and all this sort of thing. So the LWF statement, as you can tell from the title, intentionally juxtaposed greed with the meaning behind the assembly theme, which was, give us this day our daily bread. And that was intentional to say, how do we find ways not just to get people lost in all kinds of endless in-depth analysis, but in a way that can really name what is the juxtaposition that we're dealing with here. The greed that has been blatantly exposed in recent years with some financial leaders even boasting that greed is good, if not also God, is not just the greed of individuals, you know, saying, oh yeah, let's look at those greedy individuals who appear before some congressional hearing or something. But what we were trying in this statement to say is that we're dealing with something that is systemic or structural. And it is a part of us as churches. It's not just out there. And so the statement declares, structural greed is a spiritual matter of idolatry. And the four slides I'm going to show you now are all from the section that talks, that is headed, structural greed is a spiritual matter of adultery. I-D-O-L. Okay. I'm twister here. Okay. We deplore that instead of speaking out to challenge and change the way in which systemic patterns and policies of greed are ruling our world, church leaders often proclaim and model a gospel of prosperity or are complicit with the ways of empire, especially in pursuing gain at the expense of others, rather than being consistent advocates of daily bread for all, as Jesus himself modeled and taught. As Christians, we cannot pray this petition without protesting the many ways in which greed prevails over the generosity for all, which this prayer affirms. The dominant economic model today is based on assumptions of scarcity, in opposition to the biblical view of enough for all. The overexploitation of natural resources is based on assumptions of endless plenitude, in opposition to the biblical view that human beings are to be the stewards or caretakers of God's creation. The interrelated crises we face today have come about because human beings have reversed and thus violated both of these divine mandates in Genesis. And there's many other examples cited besides just Martin Luther. I know not all of you are Lutheran, but nevertheless, I figure I have to, in this setting, especially raise up what Luther said, because...
I've heard of it.
Good, I'm glad. But I think it's, and I know there's people like Samuel Torvin at PLU and others who've really done some interesting work with Luther in this regard, but I think it's really important for us to reclaim some of the rather strong things that Luther said and did, which for the most part, Lutheran churches in this part of the world have not raised up nearly as much as we might. He spoke out against sinful systems and practices that oppressed and impoverished people. Before I go into this, let me say that one of my friends who is a pastor in Australia who ministers among the indigenous peoples there, and most of whom are illiterate, including the indigenous pastors, he said, you know, it's a tragedy because the Australian Lutherans translated part of the scripture, but only a very limited part of it. They translated the New Testament and the Psalms, but none of the prophets. And so a prophetic outrage of what indigenous people in that rather affluent country have been undergoing for centuries. It's in some ways a reflection of what's also happened here. But in some ways, it's even worse in terms of the disparity that's going on there. He said, you know, why are they not reading this Luther? You know, this was so foreign to what they, you know, the understanding of Lutheranism that they had brought to them. So his whole mission is to make sure that this kind of stuff gets read and heard by especially indigenous Australians. Luther clearly said no to practices of the banking and trading companies of his day, the Fuggers. Nothing good can come out of them. If the trading companies are to survive, justice and honesty must perish. If justice and honesty are to survive, the trading companies must perish. What's important here is that he was referring not only to a few greedy individuals, but to the system and assumptions upon which it was based, in which making ever more money became divorced from meeting human need. Now, here I think one has to realize, you know, you're dealing with 16th century understanding. So the kind of systemic analyses that we might engage in today, we're just getting started. Actually, one of the people who was working with us on this was Ulrich Ducrow, the German theologian who's raised a lot of this stuff, and who's really, I think, tried to bring that those Lutheran perspectives that have been ignored. And he's had trouble even in Germany to raise that up, you know, because in the 2003 assembly we said, yes, this kind of market way of thinking becomes an idol. And the LWF said that. But when the Germans translated it, they left that part out of the assembly message. So in other words, there's ongoing struggles of how do these words get through, which are important words to be heard. In the 16th century, the crisis was, as we all know, over the gospel that frees people from the fear and bondage of sin, which had become embedded in systems that needed to be challenged. Today, people also are in fear and bondage over the sin of greed as embedded in the economic system. They fear what the future will hold unless dramatic changes are made for the sake of global economic and environmental justice. Systemic greed, therefore, becomes like the domination or bondage of sin that is expressed through the theology of Paul and Luther. It becomes the idol for which lives, communities, and the rest of creation are sacrificed. Money and financial markets take on a life of their own with the creation of an endless variety of new financial instruments for making quick hyper-profits. More than just a medium of exchange, money has become a commodity from which ever large profits are promised and expected. And when these promises are betrayed, or when the system collapses, the undergird idolatry is exposed.
That's profound. That's really profound.
Let's hear some other reactions.
Well, we just had a thing last night about seeing, and I wonder how much is the idolatry exposed? I think we, in our present climate, continue to delude ourselves with our illusions and everything.
It's like the lady said at Matins this morning, that's part of the insanity.
Right.
An unwillingness, an inability, a refusal to see.
To see the truth.
To see the truth. Mm-hmm. It's like a fish in water, doesn't even know it's in water, trying to make that fish critique the water in which it's in.
Yeah. And we're those fish in the water too. I mean, it's not that we can just say, why aren't they seeing it?
And the church is a part of that, as you had mentioned.
My friend who voiced last night as a layman is a retired economics professor. Mm-hmm. And
he's out hiking today, that's why he's not here.
He was not able to come. He had made a promise and he didn't want to break his promise. But he is an extremely frustrated person, because he does not hear in the church the kind of prophetic voice that Luther exhibited on the previous screen. Mm-hmm. I met him for the first time, and I was preaching at our home church, and he said, that was a good sermon, but you did not go far enough. And that is, I have two sons and a brother-in-law. who have left the church because they do not hear the voice, and they're out there fighting the fight. My youngest son with the Paul Wellstone Foundation, trying to communicate the message of the inequality that exists. My brother-in-law with legal aid, fighting the battles of the state of Minnesota for the ill, the handicapped, physically and mentally disabled, and they've turned the back up on the church because they do not hear that voice, and myself included. I made a comment last night, and I noticed you winced afterwards, that I didn't think that there was a person in this room who had the guts to be the voice to speak that. And I'm still not convinced that his frustration is that he sees these things he told me, I give you a proxy, I can speak in your stead. He said, this is clergy talking to clergy and creating a language that really doesn't make any sense to he, who is probably has more qualifications than anybody in this room. And yet he is very, very frustrated because he does not hear a voice. He does not see it. My sons don't see it in the church. And I must admit, I'm retired now, so maybe I'm out of the fray. And I'm as guilty as anybody else. But I think that somehow we have to, as a church, take back the meaning of what Christian is away from these, if I may name names, Perry and Bachman and all of these people who are speaking out in the name of Christ politically. They're not speaking for Christ as far as I'm concerned, but we need a voice.
Okay, I know we could probably do it a lot. Let's have one or two more here.
I agree with this gentleman here, and I see something so well articulated on the screen, and then I think of trying to put myself in the shoes of other people that would respond to that, and I'm really left with the utter ridiculousness of, well, kids are reading Harry Potter, or immigrants are ruining the nation. This, the smoke and mirrors that people use to not talk about what's on that screen there, that's really affecting people. Because we're not talking about it. The people that you were bringing up are talking about, the correct words, the Star Spangled Banner, or how Tea Party they are. These are the issues, but I don't know of a medium where everyone could come and actually use their words like the song says that we sang earlier. But I don't know of the time that we're actually going to have a dialogue about what's on that screen. Instead of talking about the marginality of faith-esque things,
but you see, I'm saying it's these realities that are in fact gripping people, and that therefore, to me, and that's why I'm defining it not as an ethical issue, but a basic faith issue to begin with. You know, where do we? And I think therefore this is really a moment of reckoning for us, especially in this country, of where our faith really lies. And it's not just the economic, but it's the other. I want to just move on because I think we could keep going on in a lot of these discussions, and I think they're really good and important. But to try to grapple with the question of what can effectively expose this idolatry. Now, even though I've shared something that was a public statement to LWF, which unfortunately I left right after and therefore wasn't able to figure out how is this going to get more promoted and whatever. So I think it's, for the most part, pretty invisible, including here in the U.S. And I would not want to say that that what we turn to is top-down pronouncements as the way to expose it. Certainly that they may play a role. But I think the exposing of this idolatry, and this is why I think this in parishes and local ministry settings is where this especially can happen, is from out of the actual contradictions as people themselves experience it. The urgent pastoral task is to stand aside, for us as pastors at times to close our mouth, but at least to show that we're courageous to name some of these realities, but then to open up ways for people themselves to lament, to name, and to rage about the contradictions between what they have been promised by a distinctly American dream kind of faith and what they are actually experiencing. To lament, to rage, at times even outrageously to do so. There rarely are places, spaces, or even times, even in churches, where this can freely occur. This is actually another way of talking about subversive remembering, you know, remembering what we've experienced. Just to give you an example from my own ministry, when I was a pastor in Brooklyn, New York, it was during the time that the wars in Central America were raging, and I had my mostly working class parishioners during the Lenten series read two pages of what was happening to someone in Central America. I can't even remember which country it was now because it was 30 years ago now. And all of a sudden, in the midst of this, one of my parishioners, who was kind of, you know, stereotypical redneck kind of guy, you know, one would, you know, wasn't highly educated, had a pretty tough life in lots of ways. And he said, when he read about what was happening to the peasants in Central America, he said, you know, I know what it's like to have somebody stepping on my neck. And all of a sudden, what began to spill out was all of his experiences of being oppressed as a worker. And that began this whole, people then started making all these connections. I mean, they were ready to, Alexander Haig was the, I guess, Secretary of Defense.
State.
Yes, they were out ready to go out and impeach him right after that. And shortly after that, I left, moved to Chicago, came back about a year later and discovered that that little tiny congregation in Brooklyn was where the New York City-wide celebration or commemoration of Archbishop Romero's life was going to be taking place. You know, and this was, you know, a fairly conservative, quiet, you know, but all of a sudden they began to make some of those connections and connected it with their own lives. And I think it's those rich experiences of how people begin to name that, and then name the gap between the promise and the reality. It is sobering to realize how blatant these contradictions have become to so many people recently. People who now readily point to contradictions between what the economic logic promises, namely, you know, trickle down, or yes, if we, you know, do this or that, yeah, somehow that will result in jobs through some circuitous kind of route, and what is actually delivered economically. For example, the lack of any correlation or much correlation between the stock market and the labor market. Even though if the job market is bad, that usually results in a dip in the stock market. But overall, this feels like an increasingly betrayed promise to more and more, not just to the poor and the working class, but increasingly those who have been middle class. Those many who now feel like or are seen as losers, and who become increasingly invisible, even in our churches. Now, that's been the tale of European churches for a long time, where working class have long disappeared from many of the European churches. But I'm talking about those who are overlooked, forgotten, not remembered. And again, evoking those experiences, making it possible for those experiences to be named, is, I think, another example of how this subversive remembering works. People who yearn for more than sympathy, more than a pat on the back and say, oh yeah, things will get better, just wait. But who yearn for a solidarity that can lead to transformation of the assumptions, of the systems, and of the policies, or of the gods to which they themselves have been sacrificed. Walter Brueggemann points to the analogs between the American situation of decline today and the situation of exile for the Old Testament Jews. Rather than abandoning faith or wallowing in despair or retreating to privatized religion, this led instead to some of the most daring theological articulations in Scripture. If you read, for example, the latter chapters of Isaiah, good news about God that cannot be suppressed. Exiles must grieve their loss and express their resentful sadness about what has been lost, raging for the world that is no more, lamenting for the waning of U.S. dominance or even of the strength of churches in the U.S. A sense of being abandoned, no longer blessed by God, at least no longer blessed by a God who is identified with being successful. Despair, says Brueggemann, is a defining pathology of our time, robbing the church of its missional energy and stewardship generosity. Note the significance of that. I mean, our churches talk a lot about the importance of mission and stewardship, et cetera, et cetera. But are we, in fact, getting deep enough into the heart of the problem that will unleash that missional kind of energy? The despair that doubts God's fidelity to care and remember, and that doubts God's power to save, which is why other means of salvation are pursued instead. Certainly mixed in with all of this are all of the sayings that reveal a kind of faith in American exceptionalism. Obama himself often will, in his speech, have that somehow come up. A combination of faith in the American dream and in American exceptionalism, that you can make it here, if nowhere else, is regularly encanted by leaders, whether from the right or the left. One of the slides I could have put up here, but I realized I had some others I could have put up here too, but I think this was a familiar one to many of you. Doug Spieth has recently produced an index that indicates all of those measures by which the U.S. is no longer an exception. So among the 20 major advanced countries, we now have the highest poverty rate, both generally and for children, the greatest inequality, you know, a scandalous inequality of incomes, as we talked about, as some of you cited last night. The lowest government spending as a percentage of GDP on social programs for the disadvantaged. The lowest social mobility. Many of us would think of, well, Europe, you don't really move upwardly there. Well, they have a much, much more social mobility than we do right now. And all kinds of measures. Highest high school dropout rate, except for Spain, the highest homicide rate, and as many of us are aware, the largest prison population per capita of anywhere in the world. You know, and so Spieth and others would say, is that what American exceptionalism looks like? You know, in other words, there's lots of contradictory evidence against the kinds of prevailing myths and stories. So I think the question that we as folks in the church, whether I'm church leaders, lay people, etc., need to ask is when the U.S.'s global domination finally ends, and along with it, the belief in American exceptionalism, there will be painful daily reminders of what such a loss of power means for Americans in every walk of life. As a half dozen European nations have discovered in recent centuries, imperial decline tends to have a remarkably demoralizing impact on a society, regularly bringing in at least a generation of economic privation. As the economy cools, political temperatures rise. We have plenty of evidence of that. Often sparking serious domestic unrest and anger that responds to what can be dangerous populist appeals. So I think the question we really need to ponder is, as pastors and other church leaders, how will we face and deal with this? Pastorally minister to those affected? Of course, that's part of what we need to be about. Trying to reassure parishioners that America will still be on the route to dominance in the world again? Maybe not. Peter Larman, I noticed this on Religious Dispatches, which is a very interesting internet site. I think he served as a pastor in New York City, and in an article called Humiliation and Success in the Great Recession, has these words. I have a theory about what might begin to unfold if more religious leaders would step up to create sanctified spaces for real conversations about the new normal. New normal is what he's, you know, capital letters, the new normal. First, everything that is false and trumped up about our culture and our politics will stand fully exposed, including the lies and myths we tell ourselves about what it means to be successful and about the pageant of democracy put on by the plutocratic state. Second, the people entering these sacred spaces will find themselves personally exposed in respect to what they really desire, which is another way of saying that the God dwelling in them will become a bit more active and a bit more vocal. The godly desires thus exposed will turn out to be pretty basic. People desire companionship and a sense of shared enterprise, first of all. They desire a whole lot more truth-telling than is usually available in the public culture. They desire concrete ways of showing solidarity with others who likewise experience employer abuse and humiliation. They crave a chance to organize and to voice public outrage over the trashing of what little remains of the social contract in the United States. And, Larman concludes, I almost forgot to say that religion, in the sense of conventional piety, doesn't and shouldn't even enter into it. There's no real need for any kind of God talk in this context, And small group participants will be disturbed and offended if a sponsoring church that says, oh yeah, we're going to have this conversation about what we're going through, tries to exploit people's vulnerability for their own ulterior purposes. The meeting space will be sanctified not by anyone's particularistic prayer, but simply by the glory of God that is revealed when human beings come fully alive in an atmosphere that respects and welcomes them. I believe it's called reverence. Reverence. End of Lehrman. L-A-A-R-M-A-N is Peter Lehrman. If you want to do a Google search of the full of what he talks about, or what he, of what occurred in his congregation. Okay, but I would still maintain, I would want to add after that, I think there still is further theological work to be done. We need constructive alternatives to the ways our hopes and desires have been shaped in this market-driven society. Consumerism itself is not really the problem, and it certainly is not the problem for those who live in subsistence levels of existence. But consuming is driven by our deep dreams and desires, which are shaped and produced socially and economically. We might recall here the words of Luther, that a God is that to which your heart clings and trusts. Jörg Rieger, who I mentioned last night, and whose book entitled, it's No Rising Tide, there's a few copies available in the bookstore, I think is one of who's really been helpful in putting together theology and economy and the future. That's the subtitle of the book. He has declared this: only by declaring ourselves atheists in relation to the God of the market can we confess faith in the God become incarnate in Jesus Christ. I think you're going to hear something similar to this in what Dan Peterson will be doing when he arrives. Rieger says, and I quote, "The incarnation is a logic of downturn." Now, if we're living in a time of downturn, how can we, again, evoke that subversive memory that the incarnation itself is a logic of downturn? The incarnate Jesus Christ transcends a form of immanence determined by the status quo in order to embrace a different form of immanence on the margins. In a sense, part of this means rethinking what we mean by immanence and transcendence. Transcendence, not, you know, another world, but transcendence that goes beyond the world as we know it, especially when it's governed by these other principles or gods. People continue clinging to faith in the American dream because most of the images and aspirations around us are focused on those who have made it, who have succeeded, who have gotten ahead. You know, Obama himself regularly, I think, will evoke those refrains. And therefore, if our focus is so much upward on those who've made it, there still is that clinging to the blind, desperate hope that I too might make it eventually. I too might win the lottery. As Hayek, who's one of the philosophers of free market thinking, said, the desire of all grows in proportion to the growing wealth of only a few. So we need to decisively shift where our faith, desire, and hope are lodged from looking only upward, whether it's those who've made it or a God who is identified with those who are the successes, to looking downward, to those marginalized, left out, impoverished, and despairing. Not only around us here in this country, but around the world. God known through a theology of the cross. That calls for resisting desire as it has been constructed and being open to the emergence of alternative desires. Desire that has to do with my good in relation to the God, the good of others. It's something that erupts not from above, but from below, from the underside. By looking around and pursuing solidarity with those who truly are left out around us and around the world. There God labors in solidarity with the people and resisting desire, a desire of resistance, spreads from there. Let me just say a few more things about hope, and then let's spend the rest of this session talking about some of this and figuring out, you know, does this make sense or doesn't it, and how do we see ourselves moving with this kind of these challenges in our own ministries. I think we also need to be very clear about saying some clear things about hope. What people see and hear and experience in many of our churches still is a gospel of optimistic hope that tends at times to blur with the American dream and its promised hope. So what does this then say to those for whom this feels like a cruel and empty hope? Has the operative eschatology in American society become so tightly tied to the American dream that Christian eschatological hope is written off as only otherworldly? Again, this is where I'm pleading for theology that becomes radically incarnate in what people are experiencing and going through today. Here, too, I would draw on Douglas John Hall and some of the things he said some years ago. An operational theology of progress has been the main mood of North American Christianity, and those who cast doubt on it are unpopular, un-American. They might leave that parish rather quickly, or slowly, or at least they may feel uncomfortably if they don't preach that gospel of optimism. Mainline churches have generally failed to develop a meaningful, communicable eschatology that is not of the anti-world variety, that is not just about the last things. Salvation from a Christian perspective is not built into the very processes of history. Yet Christian hope is not a resort to optimism that things will get better, but it is a consequence of grace. It is not a program or strategy for change, nor an ideal utopian vision, but a reality that breaks in here and now. Eschatology is the interface of time and eternity. The meaning or purpose of the whole of history is introduced by the Christ in the midst of things. Through remembering and hoping, as we encounter that and experience that in the Eucharist, for example, we meet the divine presence and are able to meet and engage one another anew. And so the reign of God is a vantage point of truth, justice, and courage from which any and every system and regime must be watched and assessed. This is consistent with the whole character and intention of God throughout Scripture. From this vantage point, outrage is stirred up whenever and wherever tyranny, gross economic disparities, degradation of the earth and cosmos, discriminations and exclusions of any kind are encountered. This is incompatible, this vision of the reign of God, God's inbreaking reign, is incompatible with unregulated capitalism, greed, etc. Faith, hope, and love are given not for ignoring or getting away from the negative, which I think tends to be the typical pattern and propensity that many of us have, saying, oh, well, let's get over the bad stuff and get on with the good stuff. But faith, hope, and love are given in order to engage the negative in a transformative way. Offering cheap hope is the American equivalent of offering cheap grace. Optimism seeks to defend us from the truth, from seeing. This can only be overcome through painful exposure to the truth of both our personal and societal existence, and through metanoia, conversion, a radical break with false hope and untruth, and the inbreaking of hope that is grounded in the proclamation of the gospel, a gospel that transcends sentimentality, a faith that can live with doubt, and a hope that is about to confront despair. So, let's talk about that. Does this resonate with what you experience? How do you grapple with this? Let's share some of your own stories. Suzanne. Sure.
To me, your vision is far too small. And you're looking at the economic system, and I completely agree, it's not fair. Anyone who has power has the ability to abuse it, whether it's a corporation, or a government, or a church. And I think we should take this approach to every system of power in our society.
Yeah.
And I think as a church, we lose our legitimacy when we associate with one group that has power in order to fight another group that has power, so that the group we affiliate has more power. Because then we become blind to the abuse of power of the group we've been associated with. And I have found as a member of the church, when I bring up the abuse of power in those structures that we as a church associate with, I am given the cold shoulder by my fellow clergy. And so I wish we would expand our examination of how power is abused in our culture. And money is one way of measuring that. But there are many ways of measuring that.
No, I very much appreciate what you're saying, because in some ways I was trying to zero in on some part of it. But
absolutely.
And that's why it's over against, you know, hear what I'm saying in relationship to last night when I was talking about empire. And how all of this is interrelated, because church religion becomes a part of that, and all of the, and so it is. I appreciate very much.
And you know, we can look at all the nice things Luther said, but there was a 30 years war where he in large part I think bore responsibility for all those lives lost, because he associated closely with a power source that he was afraid to question.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, as a church, let's be very careful about our language and not singling out one sector and siding with another. I think Chris brought it up last night. You know, you jump from one ditch to the other, and
right.
Be careful about that. Yep. Otherwise, we lose our voice.
Well, and just to refer to the book of Brueggemann's, his new book, Journey to the Common Good. What's very interesting there is the way in which he looks at the Old Testament and all the ways in which that compromising was going on. So you're right. We're not talking about that somehow we've got it and others don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but we're all caught up in those dynamics. And sometimes we
we live them out even worse than others. Yeah.
There's a caution that has to be, I think, from my limited point of view and experience, about the issue of power, which in some ways is an amoral dynamic. One thing that I learned from community-based organizing is that it is essential to be able to enter into, with power, into the seats and halls of power. The question is, how do we manage that power? How do we keep it from infecting us? But power is essential to confront. You look at even the nonviolent movements, which had a huge amount of power, but not in the power frame paradigm that we're used to. Power is essential, I think, and important, but it's also very corrosive. So there has to be great caution here. But not to dismiss power altogether or to flee from it.
We're sort of sharing where we are, our experiences, our anecdotes. And I feel like we've been letting the power drain out of the word. So, for example, you know, with this whole issue of what are we as church pastors people doing in my years, 35th year of pastoring, and I've usually had a good study group, you know, with other pastors. And when we get some of these powerful texts from the Gospels, from the prophets, from even Leviticus and Deuteronomy and so forth, that challenge our structures. I mean, the manna story in the wilderness, right? The manna, all those things, I have experienced that some of my fellow pastors lean away from them. And they look for something safer. And maybe you'll be a more successful pastor if you don't have that word that is a sharp two-edged sword. It goes through bone and marrow, right? And they blunt it. They put a rubber tip on it or something. And play that safe game. And then when I feel like I'm like Amos, the lion has roared, who can but tremble? You know, God has spoken, who can but respond, speak, right? And then and so in my experience, I would generalize that there's some folks who hear that and feel challenged and even empowered in their lives to make a difference in this world where they are. And then on the other hand, there's folks who say, oh, that's just his damn opinion. You know, because there's another word, the ideology of the culture or their own desires or whatever it is, that is more powerful. And so that if the church and the leadership, the pastors and so forth, were more upfront with this powerful word of God the seventh, the sabbatical year story, the jubilee year, all that stuff, which I find pastors saying, oh, well, that never really worked anyway. So they just drop it, just throw it away. But if we weren't throwing it away, if it were a sharp two-edged sword, maybe then the folks in the pew wouldn't say, well, that's just his damn opinion. You know, there would be a more strong force to that word. This is to change us, and to change the world. I don't know that we care about changing the world anymore.
No.
Yeah.
I agree with you on that. I don't think that...
We've got somebody up here right now.
Yeah. I wonder what your take is on this one. I always felt that it was constant and it was screwed up. And, when he decided that he cannot fight against the emerging Christianity, so he decided to join it and he changed it. And he changed the message of Jesus into something that really is with the powers instead of being subversive, which you were talking about. And I have noticed this in my fairly conservative church, when I have spoken about obsession for the preservation of the privilege of the few. And I have talked against it. So somebody discovered that I'm against the Republicans. And I said, you're absolutely right. And I think that Jesus wasn't a Republican. And there we go. I was in deep trouble. And so how do you talk about these issues without engaging in political discourse? One family left the church last week because I talk about politics. And yet my letter of call says that I'm supposed to speak on behalf of the poor. How can I speak on behalf of the poor without talking about politics?
Especially because politics, broadly defined, is embedded throughout Scripture.
Yes.
People want to respond to that?
I think you go both sides. You know, the Republicans have a lot of sins to bear, as do the Democrats. And I think if you speak to injustice no matter where it is, and you don't just pick one place, but you speak across the spectrum, and don't just pick one group to pick against all groups, I think you gain a lot more credibility.
I resonate very clearly with what you said, very much. You're right, I feel you're right on target. I think the one of the things that bothers me is, I guess, I don't know the proper phrase for it, but I would call it the idolatry of demonization. And I think when the church identifies with any power, but when you identify with any power, you're identifying with that power against another power. I think the human spirit then ends up demonizing those who are not that power. And then I think it's much more difficult for the Holy Spirit to bear witness. I think a second thought is, I think one of the things we're having to deal with is church, which you were speaking to, is Christendom is either died or is near death. And the church has been Christendom since the 4th century. So we really have a lot of centuries that we really don't have the experience of knowing what it's like to be church within the world. And I think it's going to be a very difficult road for us, and we're going to have to be led by the Spirit. I see so many similarities between our age and the age of Jesus. You know, if you follow Marcus Borg, said, you know, it's like Jesus got up one day, you know, as he ended his ministry and looked at the world around him and said, "This sucks." And I think it's true. I think there's a lot of economic similarities, a lot of political similarities. You know, it's a tough journey. But I reaffirm what you say, that we can't identify with any single power. You know, but what I think we're meant to do is to live the word, speak the word, which means we live within the suffering of the world, and allow the incarnation to take root in us individually and collectively, and also realize that part of the story we tell and live is about death and resurrection. That our story is not about trying to save the United States or whatever and make sure that we don't die. I hope we don't, but we're going to die at some point, even as a benevolent empire, because I don't think we're an evil empire. I really do. I've gotten to the point where I think that we're probably about the best that's out there. I have a lot of my church are from Kenya, and they're just thriving in this culture. They're so grateful to have the opportunity to be set free and live here. We have 2 Hispanic churches. They feel the same way. But I think that's going to be very hard for us to suffer within the death of the culture, or to suffer through the death of a false story that we have been told and have been living out of.
I don't
like doing that.
Yeah, I would add to especially the first part of what you're saying, which I agree with, is that I think if we're going to go back to what does that pre-Constantinian church look or feel like, we've got lots of evidence of it around the world.
That's true.
In terms of the churches that are very much in a minority status as Christians and who are seeking to live that out. I mean, I think, for example, the Christian churches in India, you know, which are a distinct minority and often persecuted in lots of ways. In some ways, I mean, to me, the Lutheran churches there are the most prophetic in some ways. Maybe not, there's also corruption and whatever and power issues, you know, that go on there. But in terms of speaking out against the economic and political powers, sometimes in a, you know, in a way that's step forward and two steps backwards. But there's so many examples of that. And in cases, some of us were talking at breakfast at the church in Makani Yeza's church in Ethiopia, churches under persecution, which are really getting a sense of what does that mean to live out the faith now. And therefore, in some ways, it's a matter of Americans just shutting up and learning from the rest of the world.
And I just have 90 seconds, because that's just related. I think one of the part of who we were in the first three centuries, we were a community of faith. So we have to live out life in the Spirit and bear witness to the Spirit as a community. Okay? Second related thought is, I read recently that the primary means of communication among young adults, particularly teenagers, early 20s, is, I believe it was Facebook. It's no longer email, no longer letters, no longer cell phone. I believe it was Facebook. Which means the means of socializing and the means of building community has radically changed. And for us to be effective as community, we've got to enter into that change. And then the third and last thing is this. We had a day camp where we went to, pretended to go to Nepal. And we, by the movement of the Spirit, connected with a gal who had been a domestic slave until age 12, had started school until age 12, came to this country at age 18. She's now 34 with a master's degree and two children. And we raised money to help build an orphanage to rescue some of the sex slave children, domestic and circus slaves in Nepal. I was amazed at how simple and easy it was to connect with the community of faith in Nepal. So I, to pick up on what you were saying in terms of the early century church is being expressed and experienced within third world nations. I think to be true community and to re-engage post-Christendom, we're going to have to network with those, and I think the means is there, but we've just got to understand it, that our community is going to be different. We may not even see each other in this lifetime, but we will be as one through the modern technology and through the partnering with these communities. It's so simple, it's going, you know, Facebook or websites or whatever.
Carol.
Yeah, this isn't a response, I'm sorry, to your last comment, but I wanted to come back to this thing you brought up about lament. I'm thinking about it, I just think that is such a totally foreign concept to our communities of faith, in any kind of Hebraic way, or that the scriptures were written in such a communal context. They were written for a sense, not public as we understand it, but for a whole community. But people experience, well, first of all, they experience their faith in scriptures. It's about, you know, my relationship to God, and it's, you know, it's individual. And so lament, like, I want to give a little example. A woman in our church lost her son in his mid-50s, and it was quite a shock. He did not have health insurance. And he, you know, she told me this. She said, and he didn't go to the doctor. And we tried to get him to go to the hospital, and, you know, that they would pay because they'd have to pay and stuff. But he, you know, he says, well, I don't have insurance. I really don't want to go. And he waited too long. And what he had was, you know, was something that maybe could have been dealt with. But her experience of that is, I mean, one could lament that in a way of, you know, what kind of society is it that, you know, that somebody then, you know, you have to bury your son because he didn't have health insurance, you know. But we take, you know, she takes that as it's a private thing, you know, and we just have such a barrier to thinking about how, you know, whether it's people losing their jobs, it's their own failure, you know, and even something like health insurance. And, you know, how do we break out of that and to be able, the idea of having a service of lament about, you know, job closings in, you know, the city where I live or something, that would be amazing, but it's hard to even imagine how such a thing would happen, you know, it's just, I don't know.
See, I think the lament is going on in lots of other corners of society. The corner bar, or the coffee shop, or the you know, the women's circle or whatever. So I think it's going on in lots of places, but you know, how do we name and open that up? Those of us who are in some kind of leadership position in churches to enable that to happen. And I don't think here we're only dealing, I mean, some of it is a cultural thing, and we can say, oh yeah, it's these Northern European backgrounds of Lutherans or whatever. But Anastasia Mala is the first Lutheran, African Lutheran woman to get her PhD actually she did it in Old Testament at Luther Seminary a few years ago. And her whole dissertation was on the importance of lament. And I've heard her speak of how passionately she feels about, even in the African churches where we think, oh, well, it's happening there. She said, no, it isn't, because, of course, they, you know, they're doing church like they learned from the missionaries. And so the authentic lament there, and how, so I think they're, in some ways, it's touching base with where are the corners in any society where, in fact, that's happening, and how can it move from just the private, you know, complaining to help people see those more systemic connections?
I agree with all that you've brought up, and I think the idea of lament and rage is very important, and I've seen it a lot among parishioners for different reasons, and maybe there could be a more could be some encouraging to do that more even, but it always comes to a point, okay, what? What am I going to do? Or what's the church going to do? And I guess my personal feeling is that there are some people, of course, that do believe in the transformative power of God's word, and it does happen. But I think as a church, and at least in my congregation, I know there people expect something just to happen or to somebody else to do something and can't grab their hands around the fact that this has to be something that we grapple with personally and as a church to be transformed by the power of God's word. And now, and incarnate, that's where the incarnation comes in that people have been bringing up here. I know in my community, so many of the churches focus on the hereafter, you know, are you saved for hereafter? But the transformative power of now, I think, escapes many people, or that somebody else is going to do it, and it's not going to, but it needs to come from us, as individually and as a group.
Phil.
Someone here said, responding to the words that were on the board, you know, the statement and agreed, it was profound. Well, I want to share with you, in his own way, Bishop Hansen has said the same thing publicly, profoundly, in Europe. That's why, in many ways, he was elected to be president of the LWF, because many of the member churches, particularly from the South, wanted him to speak to American compliance with empire. So he speaks that way in Europe, doesn't speak that way here very much. And when he preached at our church in Geneva, he was giving a rather radical sermon using Mark as his text. And I'm sitting there listening to him and saying, guys, reading the same stuff I am. So that evening we had dinner with him, and I said, Bishop Hansen, are you reading Chet Myers? And he said, yes, and I would really like all my clergy to read that kind of thing too. Now, he said that to me privately in Geneva, Switzerland. I don't remember him ever saying that to the clergy in print, in the Lutheran, or anywhere. So this is my little vignette. You know, he has responsibilities as the president of the Lutheran World Federation, which are now offended, but he's still on the church council. And he has tremendous, wrenching responsibilities to move this church into ELCA.
Okay, are there other, by the way, that if you're looking at that plot is not right, so. Yeah.
Basically, the bottom line of what you're saying is,
okay, one more comment.
The bottom line of what you're saying is that we must be more effective, more intentional about finding ways to confront what you might call the theology of reading. We can speak philosophically, we can speak theologically, we can talk among ourselves, talk to social groups, but that's not doing this. We must find ways to be more effective.
Yeah. I one more thing on this idea of lament. There is a great need to translate lament into responsibility. The fact that the lad died because he had no insurance is because of our lack as a community to do something about it.
The societal responsibility.
And that is where the tire hits the road. Yeah.
Okay, it's time for coffee break. Please get back by 11.